Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 56 of the Assorted Calibers podcast. The Second Amendment podcast is a little bit for everyone. I'm Weirdbeard, and with me, as always, is my wonderful hostess, Aaron Paulette. How are you doing, Aaron?
That was an oddly pregnant pause right before you mentioned my name.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I was just wondering if you spaced and for a moment. And with me is my hostess.
Line.
What's her name again?
Engelbert Humperdinck. Wengelbert Slaptyback.
Yeah, you know, and that is a classic Eddie Izzard routine, but he needs to update it for Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yeah, I actually saw him when he was in Boston, and yeah, didn't do any of that. He was great, but after seeing Dressed to Kill, and he made it a point, he said that he doesn't write anything down. I guess he says he's dyslexic. And so really, he just goes up on stage and noodles until he feels that it's perfect and then records a special. And so there was a whole lot of it that was very imperfect, which, I mean, appreciate. It's charming. It was good. I got to see Eddie Izzard.
Yeah, I watched, I think, the director's... Not the director's cut, the director's commentary, the commentary track, whatever, of, I don't know if it was Dressed to Kill or Circle or one of those, but Eddie Izzard was commenting on his own routine, and so that's really meta. You know, I'm listening to a comic, watching himself and commenting on himself, but yeah, he did mention that he likes to keep it molten, to use his words.
Mm.
So.
It was apparent.
So, I may be on National Public Radio in the next few days.
Ooh, I'll do a weird audio fisk.
I hope you don't have to, but if it comes to that, go for it. So, I was contacted by someone out of the NPR branch in Orlando because we've got the Pulse anniversary coming up. And I'm such a bad person. Every time Pulse takes me by surprise, it's, oh, wait, it's happening now? I thought I had a month. So, yeah, it always pulls me up short, and I go, oh, crap. Now I've got to do something about this. So this person wanted to talk to me and do an interview either today or tomorrow so that it would go out on Wednesday, which is, I'm pretty sure, the anniversary of Pulse. And I thought, well, all right, that was pretty cool, because I've been interviewed before, but, well, the closest I've had to anything being national is Cam Edwards, and Cam is a lovely fellow, but while NRA-TV is technically national, it's, well, I think it's only on the internet at this point. I don't know that you can tune in and watch it on the TV or on a radio channel.
I used to listen to it on SiriusXM, and then something happened and it was no longer on that station, and I wasn't able to figure out if it had moved to a different station on that or not. I think it went exclusively internet.
Well, it probably happened right after Sandy Hook. That'd be my guess.
Hmm. Yeah. No, I can't remember.
It doesn't matter. So anyway, NPR, that's big for me because it's national public radio, and also because the listenership of NPR skews to the left. Mm-hmm. I actually had an opportunity to get the message out to the people that I thought really needed to hear it, and I figured, even if this is a hit piece, even if I am painted in a terrible light, the message is still getting out there and it's still being heard.
Mm-hmm.
But when I talked to him, he said that there wasn't a lot of representation of queer gun owners and that we had a unique voice and it needed to be heard. And so he wanted to talk to me about it. And he talked to me about that and Blazing Sword and Pink Pistols. And we talked for about 25 minutes. And I don't know how much of that is going to be edited. For people who may not know this, like right after... Not like right after Pulse, but I'm going to say like within a month of that and Blazing Sword was really kicking off, I was approached by some woman whose name I've forgotten now from the BBC. Mm-hmm. Stacey Dooley, that's her name. And she did a special on Pulse. And I don't remember if it was 30 minutes or an hour, but it was a regular block of time. Mm-hmm. And we talked. Well, I took her to the range, you know, showed her the basics, just basically gave her the Blazing Sword treatment. Mm-hmm. And so we did some talking on the range, and then we had an interview that lasted for, I don't know, a couple hours. And so it was all really, really good stuff. So 2 to 3 hours of material there, and my stuff was, I think, reduced to 15 minutes at most. Mm-hmm. And so I understand when you're cutting for time, you've got to cut out only the juiciest bits. But I was just shocked at how much wasn't used.
Yeah.
I wasn't offended. I wasn't insulted. But I felt a little slighted. It's like, I've got some good stuff there. You're not using it. What the heck? So, you know, I don't know how much of this is going to be used. But we'll see.
And again, unless it is the most savage hit piece on Earth, of which case... you'll be recording both sides of it anyway, so...
Oh, I already have it. It was done this afternoon.
Beautiful. So you've got you've got the full recording. So even if it's mm-hmm. Unless it is a super, super savage hit piece, in which case, just like the Katie Couric against the Virginia Citizens Defense League, like, no, that's a win in our department. Like, that literally shows mm-hmm. the people in the middle going, oh, what do you mean the bias on guns? Well, look what they did here. I mean, how else could you explain this? They told us to our faces, be quiet because we are going to be editing out the sound. I mean, I do this. All of our segments start out with, you know, 10, 15, 20 seconds where the person just turns on the recorder and they just sit in their room, or in Steve's case, his car, and records nothing. And I use that as something to sample and use it to cancel out all the noise. And suddenly it quiets down the space in between the words and it makes everything sound much clearer. And so that they told them, this is what we're doing. We just need to hear the room. And then, yeah, they then use that silence as a way to cut to them just sitting there saying nothing to make them look dumbfounded, foolish. Especially foolish when you can prove that that's what they did. But on the other hand, even if it's they're just being uncharitable to you, they're acknowledging you exist.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the biggest things. I mean, you look at the NRA, they attack the NRA and all that, but look at other groups like, you know, the Second Amendment Foundation and all these other big groups that are doing lots and lots of hard work, and they get almost no airtime whatsoever. They just don't exist. And that's one way of suppressing the message. So just the fact that they're reaching out to you, that's awesome.
Yeah. And like I've said before, sometimes even bad press is good press because people are more likely to spread things that offend them. Oh my God, did you see this horrible thing about this terrible woman who's trying to arm all the gay people? Oh, I'm so offended. I'm going to share this. And they share it and it spreads more than if they had just seen it and gone, okay, that's cool, and just went about their lives. Mm-hmm. And so by being offended, by sharing it, talking, denouncing, it may be seen by more eyes, and some of those eyes may be people who are quietly going, yeah, I should check them out.
Yeah, and to be fair, confirmation bias is a real thing. I mean, I remember several years ago, the guys from the now defunct website Armed With Reason, it was Evan DeFilippis. He's soon to be one of David Hogg's classmates. He's studying at Harvard now. He debated John Lott on some third party's podcast or something, and it was broadcast on YouTube. And he put the debate up on, you know, on his website. And from my scoring, John Lott just trashed him, because essentially he would say something, John Lott would prove it was wrong, and he would never go, wow, you got a good point there, because that's how debates work in reality. Nobody ever goes, geez, that's a good point. I've changed my mind. That'd be wonderful if that happened, but it doesn't. He instead would just completely change the subject and move on to the next point and just move on to the next point and just danced around doing nothing while John Lott did what John Lott did. And I immediately took that exact thing and shared it on my blog. I'm like, everyone needs to see this. This is awesome. And I told him, I said, it's, you know, super, super brave. I wrote in their comment section, super brave of you to share this. Like, you got trounced. He goes, in what way did it, you know, what did you see it got trounced? Oh, that video you shared. And he just ignored me from then on. But confirmation bias is a big thing. Some people will see something as the most unreasonable thing on earth and they will share it as such. And other people will see it and go, wow, that's really reasonable. So, yeah, congratulations, Aaron.
Yeah, thank you. So in about 2 days, you and I will know what happened, and our listeners, well, they'll already know about it, most likely, based on my reactions. I'll either be happy and preening or cursing and, you know, wishing death upon people. Hopefully it's the first and not the second.
I think the second is unlikely. There might be different degrees of happiness. You might be slightly displeased with how it goes, but something tells me that they're not going to have it just be a complete and utter hit piece. And if it isn't, well, we've got a platform to go after it, and we know lots of people.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a bunch of stuff to talk about, Aaron.
Uh-huh.
First up, a little more. I know we talked about NRA drama before, but I really felt that this little event needed to be brought up. I forget where it got shared originally. Do you remember where the original one came from? I saw screenshots. Someone was asking, he's, what, the second vice president? What's his current position?
Willesley is the second vice president of the NRA. He is also, last I checked, still the head of Outreach Committee, and I believe he's doing something with grassroots. It might be a grassroots committee. I might be getting the name wrong.
Mm-hmm. And so Willis Lee, was somebody asked him about President Trump's statements about the fact that he didn't like suppressors and was implying that he might be going after them the same way that he went after bump stocks. And that is a very legitimate concern. And I don't know about you, Aaron, but sounds like Willis Lee, especially given all the things that you just mentioned, seems to be one of the perfect people to respond to that. And instead, he lashed out and essentially just rolled his eyes and came up with a big old screed about just how people are trolls and that sort of stuff, and such snarky questions didn't even warrant an answer.
So weird. I kind of need to maintain a certain neutral stance here. Mm-hmm. So I am perfectly happy to let you take the lead, and I can confirm or deny. But okay, so far what you have said is true. Someone sent him a private message asking a legitimate question. I believe the question was, is the NRA going to do anything about suppressors, or are you just going to roll over like you did with the bump stock ban? Now, I'd like to point out that all of his duties, maybe not so much second vice president, but the outreach committee, grassroots development, all these other things, these are public relations posts. And so someone whose job is in PR, not in PR, but whose job is in public relations, mm-hmm. Needs to maintain a professional neutral tone. I have struggled with this myself because there have been so many times people have come onto the Operation Blazing Sword Facebook page and copped an attitude, and I have had to fight back the overwhelming urge to say, now listen up, you little shit. But I can't say that. That would be unprofessional. And so I usually just back off, take a bit to cool down, maybe ask someone else to handle it for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so while the original questioner's response was loaded, you know, he did use the phrase rollover.
Mm-hmm.
It was a valid question, and it wasn't as insulting as it could have been. It wasn't outright rudeness. It was, well, I'm sympathetic to it because I feel that the NRA should be suing the bump stock ban.
Yes. And at least even playing full devil's advocate, even if the NRA worked really, really hard to come up with the best solution and went for it, I mean, the NRA's fingerprints were on the federal assault weapons ban as well, as well as the Brady Bill and all of these horrible, horrible laws that we are dealing with, and that either we did repeal or we want repealed and all that, because they were advocating for us. And in many cases, such as, I mean, I mentioned a while back about how the NFA was originally also supposed to include handguns. And that's the whole reason why they care about whether a rifle or a shotgun is concealable or not, is that was how they were going to define a handgun. Essentially, any quote unquote concealable weapon was going to be some flavor of NFA item and subject to, back in those days, extremely heavy taxation. And it was in part with the NRA and other Second Amendment advocates that got it at least pushed back a little bit. It was a horrible bill, and it went through, and it's still with us today. And it, if not needs to be completely repealed, at least needs to be greatly reworked. But there is times when insurmountable odds, the best you can do is take some of the sting off of what is going to be a loss. And so even with that going through, even with that, I mean, the NRA of the mid to late 90s was very much sympathetic towards people who owned quote unquote assault weapons or who wanted to buy, unrestricted weapons, and people who were manufacturing them. And, you know, while they were involved in what eventually became the ban, they then immediately turned around and started fighting it immediately. And why wouldn't bump stocks be the same?
Right. So, yes, as you said, the NRA does have a history of these sorts of things. And so a certain amount of concern and suspicion is warranted. However, his response, oh, and I don't have it memorized, and I don't feel like looking it up, but it's something like, well, do you have it handy, Weird?
So the exact quote is, as a lifelong member, I'm concerned that the NRA is going to roll over and let Trump ban suppressors. What are y'all going to do about this? And Willis Lee responds, thanks for your membership and support. Your snark doesn't deserve a reply. Try again.
Yeah. Now, see, that sounds like, well, we've got your money now, so we don't care.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really bad. It's unprofessional for someone whose job is public relations. That's terrible. And here's the thing. The NRA actually has a position on the suppressors. The ILA has stated something. He could have said, well, here is the position of the ILA. Or if they hadn't said it yet, it could have been, well, we are waiting for a position from the ILA. Please stay tuned. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of things he could have said. He could have said nothing. Saying nothing would have been preferable. But he said that. And that is unbecoming. And a lot of people feel the same way, because it instantly got turned into a meme, and it was spread across, well, Facebook at least. And on his page, I haven't read all of them, because there are over 1,000 comments at this point, but all of the ones I have seen have been unflattering.
Yeah. And we don't need to dive too deep into this, but I'm starting to get the feeling that, again, this is not me bashing the NRA. I think the NRA, at least at its core, is still the great organization that those of us who defend it essentially wax about. I think it just there has grown some, I guess you could say, cancer of people who may once have been diehard defenders of the Second Amendment. And I'm not saying any of them are enemies of the Second Amendment, but they have turned from people who are doing their best to defend the Second Amendment and to help the American people. And you know what? If they can make a living out of it, God bless them. That's awesome. To people who are serving themselves and paying lip service to the Second Amendment. And this has got to stop, because this is not going to do us any favors. Again, it was a little bit snarky to say roll over on the bump stocks, because I think at its heart, that is not exactly true. I do think the NRA should have done more, and or at least maybe did all that they could then, but should be doing more now. But again, the understanding that, look, they were there and they didn't stop it, that can be frustrating and angering, and they should have sympathy for that.
I agree. I have some mixed feelings about the money, and there's an article that just came out on, I think, the Washington Post, where they mentioned that 18 of the 76 directors were being paid by the NRA, and some of those I have no problem with. As an example, there's one of them where there's a woman who is actually an instructor, and because of that, she was paid like $200 for her instructing activities. I have no problem with that. Peter Brownell, through the Brownells add-on or roundup campaign, you know, he does a lot of heavy recruiting for the NRA, and I'm sure he incurs some expenses. I'm okay with that. But there are other things that look really suspicious, such as, in the article they mentioned, $400,000 to a former football player. And I think they mean Dean Cain in that, because he played professionally for like 1 year. And according to the article, at least, I haven't done any digging, they can't figure out what he's being paid for. And then there's the $250,000 that's being paid to Marion Hammer. And so there are a lot of people who are going, this is a lot of money. And if these people are on the board of directors and the board is supposed to be an unpaid position, if you're being paid, well, all right, you have a relationship now with the person paying you. And if the NRA is paying you, that means essentially Wayne LaPierre is paying you because he's the head of the NRA. And so if the head is paying members, does that mean that he is influencing members of the board? And I don't know if he is or not. It does, however, look bad. And if this was just the only thing that we had seen, I would say, oh, they're making something out of nothing. But with all of the other stuff that's come out since April, I hate to say it, but they have exhausted my reservoir of goodwill. And I'm basically going, yeah, it's probably true. It's probably really bad.
Yep.
So, I want the NRA to survive. It is the nation's oldest civil rights organization, and there is no single organization that can take its place. I want it to live. And so I want the NRA to get its house in order, because if they don't, it's going to be done for them, and it's going to be done harshly. We are coming up on an election, and really, I think they've got at most a year and a half to get things done, because, okay, let's assume that Trump doesn't win. So Kamala Harris, Buttigieg, these are all very, Cory Booker, you're going to talk about him later. Mm-hmm. You know, if any of these people win, they are strongly anti-gun. Do you think that they will direct the IRS to destroy the NRA? Yes, I think they will. They really need to get their house in order now, and to use a medical analogy, they need to cut off the diseased limb before gangrene kills the host.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, really, I want the body to live.
Yeah.
And I understand why people don't want to make the hard decision. Again, continuing the analogy, this is my body. I don't want to lose it. Well, you have to, or you're going to lose everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's going on here. And I really hope that there is an NRA when this is all done. And really, it depends on the 2020 election. If Trump is elected again, then they've got until the end of his term to get things sorted out. And the way the pendulum shifts, it'll probably be the exact opposite, a hardcore liberal anti-gun Democrat. They have between 6.5 and a year and a half to get this sorted out.
Mm-hmm.
So, guys, get your house in order, please. All right, so let's talk about another uncomfortable thing.
Yeah, it was Wednesday of last week. We're recording this on the 10th. There was another mass shooting in Australia, and I really wanted to just bring this up because it's something you hear all the time when somebody is talking about gun control. You know, be it the people in New Zealand pushing through their horrible gun control right next door, or the people here, is they say,
we know that other countries, in response to one mass shooting, have been able to craft laws that almost eliminate mass shootings. Friends of ours, allies of ours, Great Britain, Australia, countries like ours.
And they never had another mass shooting.
Monash University says what?
Yeah, exactly. There have been a bunch of mass shootings. And then again, I point out, I've always just been completely disgusted by this metric of gun death, where people talk about, oh, the gun deaths in America, or the gun deaths per capita, or all that. And I'm just like, why are we talking about gun deaths?
Because knife deaths and car deaths are wholesome.
Yeah, yeah. Because, yeah, if somebody gets... I mean, so I've got... It's in the show notes. I've got a link of... What's the Wikipedia page called? It is called Lists of Massacres in Australia. And let's see. So, again, this recent one, it was in Darwin. It was 4 dead, 1 injured.
Didn't this one involve a shotgun?
It involved an illegal pump action shotgun. They at least on the story that I've got linked in the show notes, they don't know if it was a legally owned gun before the Tasmania massacre and pump actions were banned and just the person didn't turn it in, or if it was acquired by some other means. But it was, and again, let us not let it slip by, it was an illegal pump action shotgun, as in the super duper sporting kind, according to our anti-gunners, at least right this exact second. September of last year, there was a mass stabbing in near Perth, and let's see, there was another one in what I was going to actually is in January of 2017 in Melbourne. I'm saying that wrong, people of Australia. My apologies.
Melbourne.
Yeah. Six were killed, 27 were injured when somebody drove a Holden Commodore through a mall.
What's a Holden Commodore? I mean, I know it's a vehicle, but a car, a truck, a minivan?
It is a car. Holden is the GM subsidiary in Australia, and Australians make really cool cars. It had a very, very brief appearance here as the new updated Chevy Caprice. I believe they also called it the Chevy SS, and they tried to make police cars out of it. I don't know if it ever really sold that much, but it is very... It's a Chevy Caprice.
They tried to make a police car with the initials SS.
Yes, for Super Sport. That's a standard Chevy badge.
Sure, yeah, yeah. Sure. I'll take Tone Deaf for $500, Alex.
I never thought of that, but my goodness, you are dead on. But again, these people were killed by a guy in a car, and that is not a gun death. And more people were killed and more people were injured in this attack than with this shotgun death. I don't remember hearing about that one.
No, I hadn't heard of it either.
Yeah. So just the whole metric of, I mean, these are lives being taken. This is not a laughing matter. I mean, a dead person is a dead person, and specifically a dead person by malicious violence. I don't think it really matters that much to the bereaved that some horrible person murdered your family member if they ran him over with a car or shot him with a shotgun. So, again, I don't like this whole metric of the, you know, shooting deaths and all. And I appreciate that Wikipedia put this list down as massacres. So it's got the several. There's some really brutal arson attacks that happened in Australia. It's a malicious act. It's the people, not the tools used. Either way, the whole idea that there has not been any mass shootings in Australia, there have been several. And even using our definition of mass shootings, or really whichever definition, there's a bunch. So, yeah. And Also, the libertarian side of me has to also point out that on this list, the really, really big ones have been the colonial people of Australia wiping out the Aboriginals. So in the end, say what you will about mass shootings, the government does it a whole lot better.
Yeah, I think you'll find that governments killed more of their own citizens in the 20th century than anything else. You know, more than warfare, more than, well, I'm not entirely certain about disease, because, you know, the Spanish flu right after World War I killed a whole bunch of people, mm-hmm. but still, it seems like government killing their own people is at the top of the list.
All right, so one last bit of news. This one is, it's also bad news. It's the bad news show.
Oh, geez. Next week, nothing but ponies.
Nothing but ponies. We will talk about ponies. We will talk about fuzzy baby ducks and maybe a bunny or two. We like bunnies. They're Yay! Soft.
they need all the pat-pats.
It needs to be soft and it needs to have sweet little eyes. But yes, YouTube, the wonderful, benevolent YouTube, is having themselves another adpocalypse. It was mentioned a while back. I can't remember when the last big one was, but certainly gun channels were hit very, very hard by the adpocalypse, where suddenly a whole bunch of channels that were gun channels and a bunch of others. There was some talk about like it skewing towards conservative channels and all that. I'm a little bit skeptical on that because I've got a very, very, very broad YouTube taste. And I found that a lot of people, even people that I would not consider to be conservative and people that were not gun involved, were also complaining about the adpocalypse. So it was really just anybody that wasn't super duper wholesome, sweet, really, let's face it, grown-ups unboxing toys and playing with them, were getting hit with their ad revenue by YouTube. And I kind of chalked that up as YouTube really just getting greedy and noting that they are creators, and the creators are going to create whether they get paid for it or not. These people, they need an outlet, and right now YouTube is their outlet. And let's face it, they cornered the market. There's a bunch of other, I mean, like the gun people have gone over to Full 30. I've watched a couple of videos on Full 30, but it's a pain in the butt compared to YouTube. And let's face it, I don't want to just sit there and watch gun videos all night. I like gun videos, but I'll watch a couple of gun videos. I'll watch a couple of cooking videos. I'll watch a couple lockpicking videos. There's a bunch of stuff that I like to watch and I like to mix it up. And that's what I like about YouTube. So they knew that leaving YouTube was really not an option. So if they're not going to go, why pay them?
So for people who don't know what we're talking about here, there are people who make their living uploading videos to YouTube, and they get money from it because advertisers place advertisements, you know, the annoying, the pop-up ones, the ones you have to watch before you watch the video, all that stuff. And the people who monetize their videos, they get money for it. They get paid based on the number of views because it's assumed that the people watching the videos watch the advertisement. And so when a video is demonetized, it just means that the ads are removed and the creators do not get payment for this. Now, Weird brings forth a good theory that the artistic types are inclined to just upload regardless. And to a certain extent, he's correct, but he's also incorrect, I think. Because if you are an artist and you want to make a living at it, and there is an agency that is doing its best to prevent you from making the money, oh, we'll take your stuff, but we won't let you make a living at it. They see that as unfair, maybe even some type of theft. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people will no longer deal with the hassles of uploading YouTube. Because, you see, in order to have a really popular channel, and in order to make that money, you have to have lots of viewers. And the way to have lots of viewers, well, you have to have good content, but you have to have regular content. And these are people who are uploading, like, every day. And that's a lot of work. And if you can't make a living doing that, a lot of people will say, screw this, I'll put my time and effort elsewhere where I can get paid. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, this is driving away content. And YouTube does not exist without content. Yes, the structure remains, but unless they are creating their own videos, yeah, I mean, YouTube is a video hosting platform. Without videos to host, they're nothing. And they are driving people away. And I don't understand the wisdom of that, and exactly the same reason that I don't understand the wisdom of why Patreon is deplatforming people. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the same sort of thing, just a different type of media. It's, you know, you get money by letting people use your soapbox. If you start restricting content, you're hurting yourself. It seems that they're doing this in the hopes of some sort of passing ideological purity test. And, well, it remains to be seen whether or not that's successful, but it does seem that the free market understands that catering to politics instead of to what is popular is a good way to go out of business.
Having explained the core of the problem, the essentially what sparked this all off is, as far as I could tell from most angles, is that there has been a tiff between conservative comedian Steven Crowder and Carlos Maza at Vox. And I will say right off, I've actually got two videos linked that actually explain with a whole lot more research than I'm gonna lay out just for this little blip. But it is Tim Pool and Liberty Doll, who, and I picked them specifically because I think they both did an excellent job at really not taking anybody's side directly, and certainly they weren't particularly pleased with how Carlos Maza's handling himself, and I'll explain that. But also we're pointing out, let's be honest, as far as I'm concerned, Steven Crowder he's a conservative pundit, he's a comedian, and while he's all of those things, he's also a homophobe. And Mr. Maza is an open homosexual and self-identified queer gentleman. And Steven Crowder has made sport of that, which, again, did him no benefit and was really, really cheapened all the good points that he was making in rebutting Vox's really terrible videos. Maza has attacked him, was reaching out to Google. There is, in some of these videos, there are references that he was directly being contacted by Google, which, if you start watching any videos of people talking about Adpocalypse and trying to get, money back towards videos that they believe is not in the wrong, actually getting a hold of somebody at Google is next to impossible. And there's actually some interesting videos where people pointing out, like, asking weird questions in emails just to see if they were talking to a real person or just talking to a bot that was pretending to be a real person sending an email. I think the big point to like Tim Pool's discuss of Maza is that Vox is not a small company. Vox is a subsidiary of NBC. I believe has some ties directly to Disney. He's got some huge financial backings. So if YouTube got nuked, it's not going to be a problem with him. While Steven Crowder is just, he's his own business. He's running a gig very similar to what we're doing here at ACP he has the show. He puts it out on YouTube. The hopes was to originally he was getting ad money from YouTube for that, but now that's not going to happen anymore. But he sells bonus content, to people just like we do here at ACP as a way to, defer his costs. And, it's just ugly and snarky. And I'm going to put it in the show notes. We covered a Vox video. I specifically did an audio fisk of Mr. Mazza talking anti-NRA propaganda on Vox. And one of the things that I was thinking about as I was thinking about what we were covering there is just what a catty little jerk Carlos Mazza is. I mean, he was making his arguments against the NRA, but then also just making snarky little snipes at whatever else he could to belittle and demean people on that. And this is really exactly what Steven Crowder did to him, but you can't do it to me. I'm going to contact YouTube and I'm going to get you nuked. And so Steven Crowder has had all of his ad revenue. He is no longer, I guess he's no longer a YouTube partner, which is the plan. You could have, I mean, I've got a YouTube, you know, account and all that, but I don't use it. So I'm nothing to YouTube. But if you have a certain amount of subscribers and videos uploaded, and I can't remember what the exact, it's, I'm sure it's ever shifting like everything else on YouTube. You can become a partner, and the idea is now you are sharing in some of the ad money that YouTube is making for all of this. And Steven Crowder is no longer a partner, but also like a bunch of people, like there's a school teacher who covers history and has covered like history of the Third Reich, and he's had a whole bunch of his videos dumped because it's got Hitler in it, so therefore he's obviously a white supremacist.
Yeah, at history videos, history used to teach people is being censored because it says Nazi. Oh my God.
Should we say censor or shall we say memory hole?
Well, I mean, I think they're basically the same thing, so whatever floats your boat.
Yeah, let's just say we've always been at war with East Asia.
Classical reference.
But yeah, either way. This is the one time where I'm going to say, thankfully, we are so small that it does not appear that the fact that we also don't like Vox has not caused us to incur any flack. By all means, share this podcast with other people so that maybe someday we can, because that seems like a good problem to have. Either way, I wanted to talk about it because, again, this is something that we are tangentially involved with, and the whole idea of deplatforming is something that is always at the back of my mind that, oh, suddenly I might be having the wrong kind of opinions and the wrong kind of thoughts in this podcast. And suddenly that makes me unpersoned. And, I mean, I'm talking on a podcast about the Second Amendment. I'm a First Amendment guy too. And this is just disgusting on that level. All right. Well, let's shift a little gears. And Aaron, you mentioned Cory Booker as a potential presidential candidate. So he is the New Jersey senator, and he is a perennial favorite of the Weird Audio Fisks. Because, again, New Jersey, anti-gun state, anti-gun senator. So because of that pedigree in his presidential run, he's been a little more vocal than many of the other anti-gun Democrat candidates for president. So I have an audio fisk of him. So I need to get this fisk out there. Cory Booker is insanely anti-gun, and so I love to target him for fisks. It's even better now that he's running for president. Except he's polling the low single digits, and I'm worried that if I don't fisk him now, I won't have Cory Booker to kick around anymore.
Just think how much you're going to be missing. You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
So this is Senator Booker on the streets of Newark, because that makes for awesome audio, trying to differentiate himself from the other anti-gun Democrats.
And there are common sense things that even NRA members agree we should do, but we're not getting it done.
Oh yes, the big lie of even NRA members support gun control. I've pointed out time and time again, in deep blue states with restrictive gun laws, anti-gun laws pass by a bare majority. In states with any sort of gun culture, anti-gun laws fail almost all the time.
Just by having universal background checks, the murders we don't talk about enough between intimate, like where your spouse kills you, they go down. Violence against women in that sense goes down 40% in states that have enacted those laws.
except the vast majority of people killed by firearms, either suicide or homicide, are men.
A semi-automatic rifle that was used in this shooting, that's not typical. Usually...
No, it's 5% of all...
Mostly it's handguns, right?
But nobody is talking about banning handguns. Why? Because it's always been a losing issue in America. So losing that the National Firearms Act was originally supposed to include handguns. That's why the law takes such concern about the overall length of a rifle or a shotgun. It was defining handguns. Except that was such an unpopular idea, it got struck from the bill. Senator Booker is no different. So yeah, instead he's proposing background checks to prevent gun deaths and domestic violence, and assault weapons ban despite long guns not being used in crimes. Because he's just fitting his agenda to the tragedy of the day.
So there's things we can do, there are levers we can pull that can make us much, much safer, but we're not doing them.
Oh, Senator Booker, he's going to make us so much safer. But Cory Booker is from New Jersey.
I have seared into my mind the gruesome realities, literally with a gunshot victim bleeding to death as I vainly tried to stop him from dying.
But wait. New Jersey has some of the most restrictive gun laws in the country. They have a permitting system that is essentially a universal background check law. They have a handgun registry. They have an assault weapons ban. They have a magazine ban. There is no private sale. Concealed carry permits are may issue and essentially don't exist. They even have a red flag law.
I mean, that's the irony. I could sit here and name shootings of bodies I've seen on the sidewalk.
When pro-freedom forces manage to repeal a crappy gun regulation, the anti-gunners always dredge up fear-mongering, say that there will be blood in the streets if restrictions are lifted. Except in areas where the anti-gunners get little to no opposition, there is literally dead bodies and blood in the streets. I think they may have it backwards.
How prevalent has gun violence been in this area?
You're literally standing where last year, as it was related to me, the shooter was over there with an assault rifle, killed Shahad Smith, who lived with me in Brick Towers right here. This is not an intellectual issue to me. It's not something I read about here about in the news. You're standing in a community that's been plagued by gun violence. And even though my mayor, Ros Baraka, continues to drive down the rates, this section of this street was one of the most violent places in New Jersey when I first moved here.
You mean an illegal assault rifle? There ought to be a law.
You know, you live in a community where fireworks go off on the 4th of July, kids evidence, you know, behavior of somebody with post-traumatic stress. They hide. They
think it's anxiety. A gunshot.
They think it's gunshots. Where you see in your neighborhood shrines to children, to teenagers that were on the sidewalk, teddy bears and candles. So for me, this is, I so badly want to be president because if I'm president of the United States, I'm going to bring a fight to the NRA that they've never seen before.
Gee, growing up in Maine, we had some great fireworks. Even when I was a kid, there were minimal restrictions on gun ownership. And we didn't have these kind of problems. Now the gun laws are even more relaxed, and I still haven't heard of any such issues.
And I'll tell you what, people in this community know that this is not just a horrific mass shooting after horrific mass shooting. We have mass shootings in our country in the aggregate every single day. So there's a sense of urgency I have that every day we lose dozens of lives by not solving this problem.
Gee, it's almost like gun control laws do nothing to prevent violent crime. Now, to be fair, if you look at the most dangerous cities, the numbers are all over the place. New Orleans and Detroit are more dangerous than Newark, and both of those cities have relatively permissive gun laws. But Baltimore and Chicago are also more dangerous, and they are equally restrictive. And Atlantic City and Camden are on the list above Newark, and they're both in New Jersey. So it's almost like gangs and illegal drug trafficking are more indicative to violent crime than gun control laws.
This is a problem that is at crisis levels in our country. In our lifetime, we're the same age. More people have died for gun violence than all the wars from the Revolutionary War to now combined.
He's not wrong, but also the facts behind it are a bit surprising. I did some rough calculations, and given that Cory Booker is 50, and there have been a steady 32,000 deaths by guns every year for as long as I can see, that's 1.6 million dead. The total U.S. war debt is around 1.3 million. But in the show notes, there are estimates that it's much higher than that. Plus, when you consider that the Iraq-Afghanistan war is the longest-running war in the history of our nation, but the death toll in almost two decades of conflict is under 7,000, that really shows that war and the mixture of street crime and suicide really aren't comparable. Further, if this is the metric Senator Booker wants to use, what is he going to do about the much greater death rate from automobiles? I mean, if something must be done, then what about cars that kill far more people accidentally than guns kill on purpose? When you look at it that way, you can clearly see this is nothing more than political grandstanding.
I'm going to come at this like folks have never seen before. I'm going to choose policy and use tactics to end this nightmare in this country. And I come home and I'm reminded by the survivors of shootings.
Look, Corey, you've been coming home to one of the most dangerous cities in America that has violence that most Americans don't see. And you live in a state that puts restrictions on firearms ownership that most Americans would find beyond reasonable. Are you not seeing the irony in this juxtaposition? Still, how are you going to come at this?
We should have a law that bans these weapons, and we should have a reasonable period in which people can turn in these weapons. Right now, we have a nation that allows, in streets and communities like mine, these weapons that should not exist.
And yet, I just played a clip where you talked about a man being gunned down with an assault weapon on the streets of Newark, where such guns are illegal. Of course, the anti-gunners will say, but this is because the gangbangers go to gun-friendly states and they buy their guns there. Well, if that was true, have you noticed that this iron pipeline model involves violent criminals going to places with considerably less violent crime in order to bring the guns back? How come these alleged gangbangers are so well behaved when they go to Virginia, New Hampshire, and Pennsylvania? Of course, this isn't true. Just look at the ATF trace data. The number one source of New Jersey crime guns is New Jersey. And the average time to crime is just under 13 years, which paints a totally different picture. Rather than guns being trafficked in as a commodity, it's likely these guns travel into the state legally as gun owners naturally move from state to state. Furthermore, may I draw your attention to a small cluster of islands in the South Pacific called New Zealand. They have more restrictive laws than even New Jersey, and those laws also fail to stop an evil person bent on doing evil things. And now, they're passing more restrictions, with promises of even more in the next legislative session. When gun owners talk about a slippery slope, we say so because it's a real thing.
She brought me to this street and she said, what do you see around you? And I described, there was a crack house that used to be here. I described the neighborhood with my eyes and she said, well, you can't help me. And I'm like,
need I cite a better example? Booker had a crack house in his neighborhood. Cocaine is highly illegal. Yet there it is in the streets of Newark, and probably in your town as well. But unlike cocaine, which I could say nothing positive about, I know people whose lives have been saved by guns.
It's actually really simple. We do it for passports. We do it for TSA pre-check. Mm-hmm. We make sure that the documentation people are putting before aligns with the truth. And so this is just basically licensing. We do this for people who are driving cars.
Yep. He wants a national licensing system for gun owners. Given that he hasn't said anything about New Jersey's May issue permitting system, I think we can assume that he wouldn't be opposed to giving liberties to the licensing authorities. And of course, you all know that I'm opposed to firearms registration. I'm even more opposed to the registration of firearms owners.
Most people don't know that consumer product safety literally had the one industry that's been exempted is the gun lobby. So we have different regulations for toy guns and no regulations for the weapons on our streets that are killing so many people.
Yeah, because the dollar store up the street from my house needs a special license to sell toy guns. And the person who gave my daughter a squirt gun in Vermont was violating federal law. Anybody who's done any dealings in the firearms world knows that this is abject crap. What he wants is to get rid of the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, which was instated because the Clinton administration was attempting to bankrupt the U.S. gun industry with frivolous lawsuits. He wants PLACA to be repealed because he wants to bankrupt the gun industry with frivolous lawsuits.
And shift the terms of the debate, which have been shaped not by legislators, shaped not by Americans. It's been shaped by the corporate gun lobby that has an insidious agenda to get more of these killing machines in the hands of people that are going to do harm.
Yeah.
Says the man with intimate ties to the Brady campaign, who is peddling Michael Bloomberg's boilerplate. This debate is not driven by the people or their representation. It has been driven by a corporate lobby. The corporate anti-gun lobby. Those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them.
Now, for a while, you have had a Fisk about the Brady campaign locked and ready to go, and I've listened to it a bunch of times, and I'm sick of it. And today, Brady was supposed to be in the rotation, and then you decided, no, it's going to be Booker. And you said in the Fisk that it's because you think that he's going to flame out and we're not going to have him to kick around anymore. I admit I don't really follow the politics. So what's going on that makes you think he's not going to be in the running for much longer?
Well, and honestly speaking, I have no idea. I can't really speculate on such things. I'm not a I certainly don't have a pedigree of picking the winners for different campaigns. And certainly this one seems to be exceptionally strange. I mean, I was just actually reading today about Joe Biden is the current front runner in all the polls, and yet Obama hasn't even stood up for him at all. So it's just a weird, weird lineup where you've got like, yeah, the former vice president who didn't run when it was essentially his term. Usually the vice president runs after his president is term limited out. But he declined at that point, and now he's up front. But Cory Booker is down at the lower. He's not quite at the, there's like a whole pack of people that are scrambling to grab the last 1% of the vote. But he's polling pretty low right now. And I just, maybe he'll turn it around, but if I was to bet, of which I am not, I would say he's probably not going to make it. And the question is, how long is he going to stick in? And yeah, so this has been sitting around for a little while, and I didn't want it to get stale.
Okay.
But one thing I just wanted to note is this is, I've got some other stuff in my Fisk folder that's going to come up in the future, but I got to love the juxtaposition of anti-gun people from anti-gun states, both praising how good their laws are at protecting their people, but also dancing in the blood of the street, which is just prevalent on the, oh, we're making New Jersey a safer place. And oh yeah, no, right on this street corner, someone was shot down in a gangland assassination. Do they not hear themselves?
Do you think the AR in AR-15 stands for assault rifle? Do you believe that it uses a direct impingement system? David is here to tell you, think again.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. Something Aaron and Weird talked about in a previous episode brought back some memories. I worked in the Netherlands for 6 months back in 1991-92. As Aaron said, never refer to the country as Holland. That would be like referring to your home state by one of the county names. When I was there, I took a few road trips. Once, for a long weekend, a friend and I drove to Paris. The reaction from my Dutch friends and coworkers was one of surprise. "That's a 5-hour drive," they said. "Sure," I replied. "Back home, we sometimes take a week off and drive to North Carolina. That's about a 12-hour drive." 12 hours, they exclaimed in shock. "That would put you in Yugoslavia." Distances are simply viewed differently there. I also took a road trip to Denmark and visited Legoland, fulfilling a lifelong dream. Interestingly, there's a Dutch connection to today's segment. They were one of the early contractors to the predecessor of the rifle I'll be discussing. In this segment, I'd like to go into some detail on the function of the AR rifle platform. One thing I'll be looking at is how the AR direct impingement system isn't really direct impingement. Before I begin, let me make one thing perfectly clear. AR does not stand for assault rifle, nor does it stand for Armalite rifle. It stands for Armalite. That's it, nothing else. If anyone disagrees with this definition, please explain the AR-17. Okay, to start with, I'd like to go over some terminology. The AR family of rifles is defined as magazine-fed, semi-automatic, gas-operated, rotating bolt firearms. Magazine-fed means that there's a spring-loaded container of cartridges waiting to feed into the action. Semi-automatic means that for each activation of the trigger, a single shot is discharged, and the firing of that cartridge operates the action to prepare for firing another round. Gas-operated means that part of the combustion gas from firing the cartridge is utilized to operate the rifle's mechanism. Rotating bolt means that the action is locked at the moment of firing by lugs on the bolt locking into recesses in the barrel or barrel extension. With basic definitions out of the way, let's take a closer look at how this mechanism operates. I've asked Aaron and Weird to provide a link to an animation of this process to help you visualize how all this works. You may want to pause the podcast at this point and start the animation before listening to the next part. Ready? Then off we go. When the operator pulls the trigger, the hammer is released under spring tension to hit the rear of the firing pin. This pin, in turn, is driven forward to strike the primer of a chambered cartridge, detonating the primer. When the primer detonates, it sends a jet of flame through the flash hole of the case and ignites the powder charge. This produces a large volume of gas that pushes in all directions. The bullet, being the easiest element to move due to its light weight and lack of resistance, moves first. As the bullet moves down the barrel, it passes the gas port. This is a small hole drilled in the barrel to tap gas for operating the mechanism. The diverted gas is directed back into the action through the gas tube, where it enters the bolt by way of the gas key. This sends the gas into a chamber in the bolt carrier behind the bolt. When this chamber is pressurized, the bolt is pushed forward against the barrel, and the carrier is pushed back towards the stock. As the carrier starts to move to the rear, the bolt is still locked to the barrel. This causes the cam pin that connects the bolt and carrier to move in its slot, rotating the bolt, and unlocking it from the barrel. Once the carrier starts to move backwards as part of unlocking the bolt, a gas port is exposed in the side of the carrier, and any excess gas pressure is vented out the ejection port. The bolt carrier group continues to move backwards together into the receiver extension, cocking the hammer onto the disconnector along the way, as well as extracting and ejecting the just fired empty case. Of course, the bullet keeps going until it leaves the barrel, at which point the pressure in the system drops to zero. As the bolt carrier group moves back, they compress the recoil spring. Once they come to a complete stop, the spring extends and pushes the bolt carrier group forward, stripping the top round out of the magazine and pushing it into the chamber. When the bolt face impacts the chamber, the bolt stops. However, the carrier continues forward, which forces the cam pin to rotate the bolt again, engaging the locking lugs. The buffer is simply there as an anti-bounce mechanism, very similar to a dead blow hammer. When the carrier comes to a stop, the metal-on-metal impact would cause it to bounce back. The moving weights in the buffer slide forward at that point and stop the carrier. All this happens in a fraction of a second, and at this point, the system is waiting for the operator to release the trigger. When they do, the hammer is released from the disconnector and passed on to the trigger sear. At this point, the rifle is ready to fire again. Regarding the gas port in the barrel, both the position and diameter of the gas port are very important to proper functioning. ARs are made with pistol, carbine, mid-length, and rifle-length gas systems, all appropriate to their barrel length and caliber. If the gas port is too big or the system length is too short for the barrel and cartridges, then the system is considered to be overgassed. This punishes the rifle and causes excessive wear to components. In extreme cases, this has been known to crack the lower receiver at the receiver extension. If the gas port is too small or the system is too long for the barrel and cartridge, then the system is considered to be undergassed. This causes short stroking, where the bolt carrier group doesn't have enough impulse to sufficiently compress the recoil spring and perform all the functions I mentioned earlier. At the beginning of this segment, I mentioned that the AR platform isn't really direct impingement. Well, it is, and it isn't.
Let me explain. No, there is too much. Let me sum up.
A traditional direct impingement process, like the Swedish M42 Ljungman, does not have a gas piston or cylinder. The redirected gas pressure acts directly on the bolt carrier and bolt. I asked for a link to an action diagram of this rifle be added to the show notes. In his September 1960 patent for a gas-operated bolt and carrier system, Eugene Stoner stated, "This invention is a true expanding gas system instead of the conventional impinging gas system." I've asked that a link to that patent be included in the show notes as well. Stoner's patent goes on to describe how the bolt within its carrier uses piston rings to contain the gas, in effect, turning the bolt and carrier into a gas piston and cylinder. ARs using piston systems, either from the factory or through modification, are not changing this process. They're simply moving the piston and cylinder from inside the receiver to behind the rear sight. There are pros and cons to both systems, and I'm not about to tell someone which system they should prefer. So there you have it, a more detailed account of the mechanical cycling of Armalite Design No. 15. I hope it helps you understand this rifle more clearly. That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments or a comment on a past segment, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook page and Aaron or Weird will make sure I get them. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
I gotta say, Aaron, I too have misidentified the meaning of AR. I have assumed that it was Armalite rifle, but he mentions the AR-17, which is in fact a sporting shotgun.
Mm-hmm. So the entire time I was listening to this, I had a particular piece of music running through my head.
What piece of music is this, Aaron?
Today on Gun Lovers and Other Strangers, David explains the operating system of the Armalite AR-15 semi-automatic rifle.
That is awesome, Aaron. But yeah, also to get into geekery, he mentions whether the AR is or isn't direct impingement, and he makes a great point. But there's certainly a whole school of thought that if the AR is direct impingement, then the AK is also a direct impingement rifle, because the op rod is connected to the bolt carrier, very similar to how the gas key is connected to bolt carrier on the AR. And it's just a question of where does the gas go? How long is that key or that piston?
I understand that there is a difference between direct impingement and not, but at this point, I feel like we are really splitting hairs.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, does rifle work? And the AR, it works. The AK, it works. The FAL, which is neither of those things, it also works. If I may geek out more, he spoke about the fact that this is essentially originally a Dutch invention. You know what else is the Dutch invention, Aaron?
Wooden shoes.
Well, yeah, they might not be the original inventors of the wooden shoes, but they certainly made them famous.
Tulips.
And windmills. Yes, Aaron. They also invented gin.
Really?
Yes. They called it either Genever or Geneva. I don't know which is the preferred pronunciation of it.
Is it because it comes from juniper trees and Geneva is juniper in Dutch? Mm-hmm.
That is correct. Yep, it is. It is.
Ha-ha!
Yep. And so, yeah, they allegedly the English were, I think they were fighting the French, and they had a whole bunch of Dutch mercenaries over, and the Dutch were drinking this stuff to gin themselves up, if you will, before a battle.
Oh.
And they called it Dutch courage. And the Brits were so impressed by it that they tried to make it as well, but it didn't turn out exactly the same. They didn't have the exact same techniques as the Dutch did. So that was where gin came from. It all is of the same lineage, is that the London Dry Gin is essentially the British attempt at Geneva.
So what happened to the original? What happened to Geneva?
It's still around.
Oh, so now we've got basically like the Dutch gin versus English gin?
Versus American gin, and there's also Old Tom gin. Oh, Aaron, we don't want to go down this rabbit hole. Don't get weird waxing about gin. Especially when I'm drinking a mint julep. That just seems wrong. Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcalibrespodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film track, and the ACP mag dump. You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com, and hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
Well, you can hear more from me on National Public Radio by the time you hear this. Aaron Paulette, kind of a big deal.
Not kind of.
And of course, you can get more from me at my nerd blog, my prepping blog, pinkpistols.org, BlazingSword.org, my public figure page, Gun Gals. I'm everywhere. Don't turn around, I'm right behind you.
Thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
He Fisks NPR. I'm on NPR. Our platforms are assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night.